This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
So they didn't notice all the mistakes and acts upon them. So there might be a number of people who took the Torah Shebichtav over the Torah Shebaalpeh. But it doesn't matter. I'm going to build the shiur this evening on some of the points that we touched last night. And then through that, develop into the Tana Debei Eliyahu that some of you will remember I used in the raising of children shiurim, which we had a couple of months ago. And that was one of the very difficult sessions, and a lot of you had problems and found the Tana Debei Eliyahu difficult, and I said that time will come to tackle it again from a slightly different angle, which will clarify it and make it a little easier to integrate. And that, in the session, is what we'll do this evening. We mentioned last night that the difficulty with the parsha of Ham and Canaan and Noach was why there is such emphasis on the relationship between Ham and Canaan, that Ham was the father of Canaan, and why it was Canaan who gets punished with this terrible curse, whereas it appears from the Tzukim that it was Ham who did the wrong. And there are many different Chazals and many different Medroshim on exactly who did what. But on the first point of the relationship between Ham and Canaan, where the Torah says in the very first pasuk of the parsha, "V'cham hu avi Canaan," that Ham was the father of Canaan, says the Ibn Ezra, "Lelamed sheshnehem ro'im." This comes to teach us that the father and son shared common evil properties. "Kemaise ovis yasu bon," according to the deeds of the father, the children do. And we pointed out last night that according to the Ibn Ezra, Ham is blamed as being the source of the bad midos, of the bad characteristics from which Canaan suffered. "Kemaise ovis," says the Ibn Ezra, "yasu bonim." The children imitate the father. And Canaan picked up his bad habits from Ham. And that's why we're told in the opening of the parasha that this downfall of Canaan, of which we're about to read, is really attributable to Ham the father. For he was the one who possessed, certainly in potential, the bad qualities which became expressed in his son. But the Sipunu learns exactly the opposite way around. And it's certainly easier from the Sipunu's point of view to understand why it is that Canaan gets the curse. According to the Ibn Ezra, that's a little bit difficult to understand. If Ham was the source of all the evil, if Canaan was merely imitating the bad qualities of the father, then surely Ham should have been the one to get the curse, not Canaan. The difference is it would have affected all of Ham's children, whereas this way it affected only Canaan, only one of his children and his descendants, the descendants of Canaan. Says the Sipurna, "The Ham hu avi Canaan," and Ham was the father of Canaan. "Doime bidrochov liknaan hamefusan l'roya." He, Ham, was similar in his mannerisms to Canaan, who was well known to be wicked. So says the Sipurna, Canaan was the source of the evil. He was known, Canaan, the well-known Canaan, the infamous Canaan, who was known for his wicked deeds. And the Torah tells us that Ham was his father, so that we should know that Doime bidrochov liknaan, he took on the appearance of the characteristics of Canaan. The father imitated the son, rather than the way that Ibn Ezra learned it, the son imitating the father. Shehoyoav liknaan be'emes, gam behid musik, for he was a father to Canaan in truth, even in as much as he was similar to him, as he took upon himself his characteristics. And we notice that that was an enormous chiddush in the Sipurna. How is it that a father takes upon himself characteristics from the child? Usually, you would imagine that the dynamics are the opposite. As the Ibn Ezra learns, that children inherit properties from parents, not parents from children. If we look at it genetically, then the only way we can learn it is that the children pick it up from the parents. But this parasha is certainly not concerned with genetics, because both are being blamed for it. Canaan is punished and Ham's name is attributed to it, so that the genetics can't be blamed. We clearly see that there's free will in the way these people behaved, Ham and Canaan. And the way the Sikuna learns, the relationship was a behavioristic relationship. These were qualities that the parents picked up, that the father picked up from the child. And we want to try and understand that this evening. How does a father pick up bad qualities from a child? And where does the child get the bad qualities from? If he didn't get them from the father, where did he get them from? Was he born with them? Did he pick it up from his environment? Where does he get them from? The answer to all that is in the Sikuna a little further on, where for a second time the Torah mentions the relationship and says, "Vayar chom avi Chanan es ervas oviv vayaged lishneyachol pachutz." And Chom, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told it to his two brothers outside. Now, at this point, we already know that Chom is the father of Canaan, and it would be seem to be irrelevant to mention at this point Chom avi Chanan, Chom the father of Canaan. Simply said Chom ben Noach. That's how we normally refer to people, by who their fathers are, not who their children are. And again, Chazal, Rashi brings various medrashim, but the Sifuna continues with his line and says, Ro'o bizoyun she'oso lo'i chanoan b'noi. He noticed the disgrace, the disgraceful conduct which Canaan exercised towards Noach, his father, Chom's father. And he, Canaan, in his wickedness, saw and did not object. He wasn't loyche. He didn't criticize. That's what Chom did wrong. And here we can begin to see what went wrong and why it went wrong. The father didn't criticize. Why not? Probably because he didn't perceive the extent of its wrongdoing. In order to be moiche, in order to go up to somebody and say what you've done is wrong, and we don't do such things, one has to be not only motivated to do so, but one has to feel a little angry at what's being done. The natural tendency is, it's none of my business, leave it alone, what can I do? The natural tendency is one of inertia. Let things be. In order to step in and say this isn't right, there needs to be a clear feeling within one that what is being done is absolutely unacceptable. If one starts off with a feeling that maybe it's not so bad, then it's very difficult to be moichi. It's very difficult to put one's foot down and to become involved in somebody else's business. That's not an easy thing to do. I want to learn with you a piece of Rabbi Tzila Petzeburger in his descriptions of his Rebbe, Rabbi Yisroel Salanter. And he says, and we'll come back to understanding this with more clarity in a few minutes, Darche tahaluchosoi imbono v'yotzei chalotzov. Rabbi Yisroel's manner, his conduct with his children, for his children. In fact, the Rambam says very clearly that the suffering that the mother bird suffers to see her children being taken away, or the suffering that a cow suffers to see her calf being killed, is no difference in extent or in quality and degree to the pain and suffering that a human being would feel in such a case. It's an amazing Rambam. It's no difference, because that pain is not a human pain. That pain is an inherent animal pain. It's intuitive, it's instinctive, something with which we're born, and in those areas there's no difference between human being and animal. Just as physical pain, there's no difference. We have the same type of nervous system, we have the same kind of bodies, and physical things, we don't differ that much from the animal. Our differences are in other areas. And this, says the Rambam, is a primitive difference in the pain an animal feels in such a circumstance to the pain a human being feels. It's perfectly natural, it requires no bechira or choice, nothing. It isn't an expression of humanity, it's an expression of nature for a parent, for a father to love his child. And he adds, Asher rabim chalolim hipilam. this nature has been the cause of many deaths. It doesn't mean physical deaths, it means spiritual, educational, and emotional deaths. Ki ha'av avere pikhim v'tisalit es darko. This love blinds the eyes of clever people and distorts their ways. Ki ha'av shochadetom lohitzi mishpat l'ufa. For their love has bribed them to reach distorted, crooked conclusions about the behavior of their children. As I said, we'll come back to that. But at this point, we see clearly what Rabbi Yitzchak is worried about and what his Rabbi Yisrael was worried about. The danger that the natural feelings of a father to a child precede the intellectual analysis of the father with regard to his child's behavior. Why aren't we allowed to accept a bribe if we're sitting on a case, even if we know we're going to judge honestly, and even if the bribe says to the judge, I don't expect you to pass it in my favor, all I want from you is that you should pass the premise, it should be true, that's all, and I'm giving you this gift in appreciation of the truth which I know you're going to judge, please don't think it has to be in my favor. That still disqualifies the dying. He can't sit on that case. Why not? Because there's an emotional attachment then which precedes the judgment. And one can't judge in a case where one's mind or where one's heart has already been made up. See, though, we're short of people tonight, so kind to let us. We have to be very careful. Aim at least, we're talking about high levels, this is not something that everybody's capable of, but at least we need to know that that's what a Torah personality is required to be, is that our emotional relationship is made or follows our intellectual analysis. Once we have decided that somebody is worthy of our love, then we love them. You don't love them first and then decide whether they're worthy or not, because once you love them, you will always find them worthy. We will not allow our minds to reach conclusions which make lies of our lives. And if we've been living in a certain way, the power, the persuasive power of the way we've been living and our need to find that that in fact is the true and correct way to live is so enormous that there's no way that we could honestly, no way, it would be very difficult indeed for us honestly to be able to overcome that natural tendency which preceded our intellectual analysis. In fact, the Chovas HaAvavos says that's why the Yetzer Hara is so strong. The Yetzer Hara is so strong because it had a head start. When the child starts off, his mind is not well developed. His analysis, his power of analysis, is not functioning properly. What is functioning? He likes sweet things and he dislikes sour things. He likes things which are nice and he doesn't like things which aren't nice. And he lives by that for many years before he starts being able to weigh things up and to analyze. And that's why you have to bribe the child sometimes to give him a sweet to do something right, give him a patch if he's doing something wrong, because that's the language which he's able to relate to. That's the only language he understands at that level. Later on, he's able to start working with his mind. Says the Chovas HaAvavos, by the time he's starting to work with his mind, he's already got a lifestyle. Very difficult even for a child to reach conclusions with his mind which are going to run contrary to the way he's lived. And so for a father, the moment the child is born already develops an emotional attachment to the child and sees himself in the child and feels this enormous closeness to the child, for that father to be able to weigh up the qualities and conduct of that child honestly, accurately, is extremely difficult and has resulted in many casualties of child rearing, says Rabbi Tzvi Petzburi. And so we find Chom being unable or unwilling to criticize his son Knan when he sees Knan misbehaving. He sees Knan treating Knan's grandfather disrespectfully in an abusive way, and Chom keeps quiet. He keeps quiet, as we said last night, because he's scared of his child. He's scared of the relationship he's developed with his child. And that comes first and foremost. Nothing comes before that. The family comes first, the child comes first, and that's all there is to it. This inability to be merchiach, this inability to rebuke a child, stems or can be treated by the Tana de Beis Eliyahu, which we learnt in that shiur to which I referred. The Tana de Beis Eliyahu is a very strange thing, we need to understand it. Velo yire odom es oviv ve es imoy kishehen medabrim dvorim yisayrim ve yachar ishlein. A person is not permitted to see his father and mother saying things, excessive things, that's the literal translation, saying excessive things and keep quiet. And the Tana de Beis Eliyahu goes on, and if they do, then it's a terrible thing, they, the child, the parents, it's not good at all. And there's difficulty understanding what these excessive words are. What is it that the child must not see his father and his mother when they're saying Dvorim Yisayrim? What does it mean, the Dvorim Yisayrim? There's a perush on the Tana de Beis Eliyahu that says Loshon Hara Kadoime. Talking Loshon Hara. Which is very difficult to understand. Why a child mustn't see his parents speaking Loshon Hara? Nobody must see anybody talking Loshon Hara. Why the word see? It should be Shomer. He should listen, not that he shouldn't see. The law is the law. Yireh Odom is obviously my person should not see his mother and father when they are saying Dvorim Yisayrim. What does it mean, Lashon Hara? Very difficult to understand. You might remember that we learned Dvorim Yisayrim not as Dvorim Asuri, not as things which are forbidden to be said, as things which may be said but not at all times. For certain things which a husband and wife are permitted to say to one another, and in fact encouraged to say to one another, but not in public. It's a certain way in which a husband and wife must relate to one another. And if they do relate to one another in that way, there can be a great deal of kedusha, there can be a great deal of sanctity in that relationship. And yet not in public. Why not? If there's such kedusha, why not in public? It's not in public. There are certain things that are not only allowed, that are required, but only in certain circumstances. And different modes of behavior are demanded of us in different situations, in different environments. That's something that we're familiar with. Different time situations and different place situations. We behave on Shabbos differently to the way we behave during the week. We behave on each Yom Tov in a very unique way, suited to that particular Yom Tov, different to other Yom Tov, and different to Shabbos. We behave in the evening differently to the way we behave during the day. And also in places. There's a certain behavior which is quite acceptable on the beach. If one's on the beach, relaxing, having a swim, quite acceptable to kick a ball around, to throw from one to another, to go running, all quite acceptable. Where does it say in the Torah you can't? Where's the issur? That's not how you behave in the shul, end of Yom Kippur. Not how you behave in the shul at all. So there are environments and situations which impose certain halachas, certain ways of behavior. Likewise, there are certain things, certain types of behavior, which are required between a husband and wife. But not at all times. In public, they're not permitted to talk that way or to behave that way. And that's what the Tana de Beis Eliyahu calls Dvorim Yisayrim. Excessive words, words which are not necessary and therefore shouldn't be said in public. And that the child should not allow himself to see. He's entitled to say to his parents, "Parents, you're allowed to speak like that to one another, but not in my presence." And we learned here that the chiddush in the Tana de Beis Eliyahu was the necessity on the part of the parents to see their children as members of the public, as well as members of the family. We'll discuss that side of it just now. But the new concept here is that when we talk about certain things may be done in private but not in public, that means not in public includes one's own children. And at the shiur on raising children, we developed that idea into understanding how to treat the children, and also that there is an area of privacy between husband and wife in which the children are not permitted. The husband and wife have their own relationship, which needs to be secured in terms of privacy, not only from members of the public and from members of the wider family, but even from members of the closer family. Their relationship is supremely private and therefore transcends the normal family dynamics. I think we discussed at that time the tendency, the modern idea of letting the children come into the bedroom at any time they feel like it and climbing into the beds, to the point where the parent feels and should feel, according to those secular views, But that's not an invasion of privacy. The child's part of me. It's no invasion of privacy at all. Says a bit from the Petterburger, many casualties have suffered in his day already. How many more in our day of such an attitude to the raising of children? But there's another aspect too, and that is the consequent inability of the parents to rebuke the child. Rabbeinu Yonah says everybody needs a Rebbe. That's not only Rabbeinu Yonah says, that's a Mishnah. I say the Charav, you've got to have a Rebbe. Rabbeinu Yonah says one of the reasons for that is just to have somebody to sometimes point out to you that what you're doing is not right. I've mentioned to you the story of Baruch Ber, who was at home during Ben Azmanim. He was learning in the Beis HaMedrash in his hometown. He sat day and night and was learning, and the Balabatim enjoyed it very much to have Baruch Ber at home. And they came to him when it was time for him to go back to the Chaim, to Yeshiva, and they said, Baruch Ber, did you learn well here? He said, I learned wonderfully. They said, were you missing anything? Were there any Sforim you couldn't get hold of? And he said, no, whatever I needed was here in the Beis HaMedrash. They said, did you feel that you steig? Did you rise while you were learning? Did you improve over the holiday period? He said, absolutely. They said, did you learn anything that you couldn't figure out? Did you get stuck on anything? He said, no. Baruch Hashem, was able to figure it all out. So they said, so why go back to Yeshiva? You've graduated already. You sit here. We'll support you. Sit and learn in the Beis HaMedrash. You don't need the Rebbe anymore. And the Baruch Ber became very disturbed and worried because they had a point. He went back to the yeshiva early the next morning and confronted Reb Chaim with what they'd said, and he couldn't answer them. They're right. So Reb Chaim said, yes, they are right. You don't need a Rebbe. Whatever you need to know, you can learn from the Sforim. You can learn from the Sforim how to learn. You can learn from the Sforim how to ask a question. The only thing the Sforim will never teach you is how not to learn, how not to ask a question, how not to answer a kasha. That the Sforim can never teach you. For that one needs a Rebbe. Vatzeichacha in learning, for rebuke in learning, in one's intellectual studies, as well as in one's conduct. No sefer, as I said this morning, no sefer jumps out of the shelf and says, hey, we don't do that kind of thing. If you look at the sefer, you might notice that we don't do that kind of thing, but it's unlikely. Because if you're doing it, it means you're insensitive to it. And the Sifrei Kodesh are not written in a coarse way, they're written with great sensitivity and refinement. And if one isn't learning it with one's eyes open and with an enormous amount of its sensitivity and awareness, one won't even notice that the Sefer is giving teichacha, that the Sefer is giving rebuke. But it certainly won't jump out of the shelf and say, who can do that? Only a living person. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, he doesn't even have to be a great person, doesn't even have to be anybody better than you, or older than you, or more learned than you. Just somebody different to you, somebody outside of you. You need an objective person, you need somebody else to say to you, that we don't do, that's not right. Because we find it difficult to see that in ourselves. If a parent finds it difficult to rebuke a child because there's an attachment from birth, how much more so to rebuke oneself, where there's an attachment from before birth already. And where we see that the furthest the Torah can go in requiring a person to love a person is to love another is kamoicha, love him as much as yourself. More than that, you can't love anybody. Just kamoicha, as much as yourself. So the absolute ultimate of love, of identity and identification is in self-love. We're not capable of loving anybody more than we love ourselves. And in that case, we're not really capable of rebuking ourselves. That it would appear to be impossible to do. We need, says Rabbeinu Yonah, even a junior Rebbe, even somebody who knows less than us, is younger than us, makes no difference. But somebody who has been charged with the responsibility of keeping his eyes open and having the courage to tap us on the shoulder from time to time and say, that's not right. That can only be achieved if we follow the concept of the Tana de Belio. That is, we begin to realize that our children are not extensions of ourselves. Our children are separate human beings with their own little neshamas, which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given them, their own personalities, will grow into their own adulthood. And our responsibilities to them are to encourage that growth and develop that growth. We'll come to that in a moment. But they're not merely extensions of ourselves. They're members of the public. And they're not even allowed into certain private areas. They're not even allowed there. Because once they have been born, they're no longer part of us. Not as the psychologists say to us today, that your children are just an extension of you and a part of you, and it doesn't make any difference, and it doesn't matter, and it's all together. Not so at all. You see the children as separate. These are separate individuals who need to be related with the respect due to separate individuals and with the sense of responsibilities expected in those types of relationship. Let's have a look at that in Italy again. It is natural for fathers to love their descendants. This nature has been the cause of many casualties. For this love will blind the eyes of wise people and distort their conduct. Because that natural love will bribe them to reach conclusions which are incorrect, which are crooked. Our Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, mastered his nature ad shum ben to the point where there was no difference in the way he saw his own children to the way he saw anybody else. Very often one learns this and thinks, what a cold sort of relationship that must have been. And then one sees this was a true relationship. The relationship of a father who wanted to be sure that he wouldn't be less fair to his children, because after all, one who is bribed is unfair, no matter whether he's bribed in favor or bribed against. If it's bribed, it's no longer fair. And whereas a parent tends to bend over backwards to be concerned with the welfare of his own child, the first requirement of that welfare is to appreciate that there needs to be fairness, and fairness means I need to understand in truth and accuracy where my child holds, whether his behavior, whether his conduct is taken good or whether it isn't. In begashmius hen beruchnis, that applied both in physical and matters and in spiritual matters. Milvad mashe mechuyu v'alpidin, accepting us. This one is responsible in terms of the halacha. We'll come to that just now. Ba'advori matikin, says Rabbi Yitzhak, and this is old, this is ancient, an ancient value. This is not something that Rabbi Yisrael was mechadish. It's just something he lived by. This is an old principle that everybody knows or knew. And that's the area where we find such difficulty today. As I mentioned last night, that one finds other people's children doing things that one would never allow one's own children to do. And other people find one's own children doing just those very same things. And very often, it's simply an inability on the part of the parent to believe that what the child's doing might in fact be wrong. He is so involved and so attached and so close, that just as when we do things ourselves out of habit, it's very difficult to stop ourselves and notice this isn't right. So when the parent sees the child doing it over and over again, the parent becomes accustomed to it. And the parent begins to accept it. It must be right. If my precious little child does that, what can be wrong with it? The problem is not just that bad children are raised as a result of that. The chiddush of the Sipurna is that that creates bad parents. Bad children make bad parents. And therefore it's for one's own protection as well as for one's responsibility towards one's children that one needs to be moichet, that one needs to criticize sometimes, and one needs to give a little bit of musar. I'm sure I've told you the story of an old yid I once met in Ne'er Shorim late on a Friday night, and an army car came past, and he mumbled under, I was right next to him walking past him, and he mumbled under his breath, Shabbos, Shabbos. And I was so fascinated that I asked him, I said, the car's gone past, the windows were closed, you want to throw some stones, I understand, you want to scream, I understand, but to mumble Shabbos that I'm the only one who can hear, what did I do wrong? Why are you telling me Shabbos? He says, no, I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to myself. I don't want to get used to seeing people driving on Shabbos, that's all. There's nothing I can do with him but myself. The purpose of Tzeichocho is not only to rectify the behavior of the other. The purpose of Tzeichocho is to ensure that I never make peace with it. And the area of the greatest danger of making peace with bad behavior is not out in the street. It's in the home. When I see my children behaving in an unacceptable way, and I leave it once, and leave it twice, and leave it three times, and it becomes the normal behavior in the home, I cease to be affected by it. And I start taking it as normal. I don't see anything wrong with it. And then you get a case, as the Sifurna says, with Chom and Knan, where the father is doime bidrochov liknan, where the father starts imitating the bad ways of the child. And we ask, where did the child get it from? The child got it from not a wicked father, just a father who would not criticize, a father who would not rebuke, a father who would not discipline. That created the wicked child. And that wicked child in turn affects the morality, the ethics of the father who begins to adopt the attitude and the conduct of the child. Lastly, we need to look at a very simple question. Why then did the Ribbono Shel Olam create our children as part of us? If they are so separate, and if that's how we're treated, why don't we just go to a child shop and choose the one we like and take him home, and that's the one that we need to raise? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam create the children in a way where they are a part of us? They are produced by us. That's a long discussion, and part of it revolves around what we said this morning, the need to understand that one is produced by a previous generation, that one doesn't, that history doesn't start with one's own birth. But apart from that, the first part of the Tana de Be'elio appears to deal with that. The Tana de Be'elio quotes a posuk and says, "Se'i elov kapayich al nefesh eloloich." Raise your hands to the Ribbono Shel Olam in tefillah, in prayer, for the lives of your children. And says the Tana de Be'elio, this very same piece, just before the piece that we quoted earlier, Mikan Omru, from here Chazal have said, Yevakesh Odom Rachamim al Atzmoi v'al Ishtoi v'al Bono v'al Bnei Veisoi. The person should be mispalel, he should pray for himself and his wife and his sons and his family. Shelo yetzei echod mehem lidei dova mechua. That not one of them should get out to something ugly, to something unacceptable. The Ribbono Shel Olam created family closeness in order to give us responsibility, not in order to blind us with love. There is a very intimate relationship with one's children. There is a very special relationship with one's children. Rabbi Tzela said that there was no difference in Rabbi Yisrael's relationship between himself and his children on the one hand and himself and anybody else on the other hand, milvad ma shemechuyov al pidin, with the exception of what the halacha requires. And the halacha requires a sense of responsibility towards one's children, where one's first responsibility is towards them, whether it's in matters of tzedakah and chesed. First responsibility is to see that one's own children have what to eat, are clothed, are educated. With money left over, one does that for other people too, but the first achrayus is to one's own children. And likewise, in the way we raise them, in the way we bring them up, in the musar we give them, in the discipline we give them, our first responsibility is to our own children. So in that sense, yes, there's a closeness and there's an intimacy. And we need to know that the children were given to us as that, in that closeness and in that intimacy, because of Se'i Elov Kapayich Al Nefesh Ol Eloich. You are responsible for them. And therefore the way they come out is a reflection of yourself. And you need to be mispalel, in addition to all your efforts in raising them, you need to pray, you need to be mispalel for Siyata Dishmaya, that they will develop properly, that they will come out as they are meant to come out and as you would have them come out. The children, therefore, are not there as a source of nachas. They always wish parents they should have nachas from their children. It's a nice bracha, but that's not what it's all about. That's not why we were given children, to have nachas. We were given children to take care of them. We were given children, we were given them to be their guardians, to bring them into the world, to bring them up in the world, to provide for them, to set them up. We were given children to provide for them, not for them to provide for us. They're not there to give us nachas. We're there to exercise the responsibilities with which the Ribbono Shel Olam has charged us. And people are so taken up, they take this bracha so seriously that you have nachas from your children, that they want to ensure that they can do so. When their children do something naughty, they don't want to get angry with their children, because that doesn't bring nachas. They don't want to rebuke their children, because their children might get upset with them a little bit. We've often talked about this terrible fear as a result that results from the need to be popular. That altogether is an interesting development in the world which affects the raising of one's children. There used to be, and in some societies still is, a need to be respected, a need to be admired. And if you look in fact in the different political setups of different countries and societies, one sees that. Countries that used to be ruled by kings. The king had to be respected. There was covered for the malchus. There was no requirement that the king had to be popular. It wasn't necessary because the king was there for life. And after the king's life was over, his child took over. Popularity was totally unnecessary. The country was not governed by popularity. And even in the British parliamentary system, once every couple of years there's got to be a popular vote, not necessarily a majority. In the last British elections, Margaret Thatcher didn't get a majority. They never get majorities of the vote. It appears a sort of majority, and popularity plays a part. But once the election's over, she does what she wants. And all she's got to make sure is that by the time the next election comes out, she's done well. But in America, it's very different. In America, there are daily polls, and the president wakes up every morning and grabs the newspaper before breakfast to see whether he's up or down in the polls, and that will determine what he does today. And each senator and each congressman grabs a newspaper, his local newspaper of his state or of his city, and checks what's doing in the polls, what do the people think of him, how does his record look, and that will determine how he votes that day. If he's going to vote for or against is determined by his need for popularity. And that permeates the whole of Western society, a need for popularity. And when a source of authority needs popularity in order to govern, then there is no authority. And that's infiltrated right into the home, where the parent wants to be popular. He wants to be liked by his child. He wants his child to love him. He wants nachas. And he gets nachas, he thinks, from those who love him. Rather than from a child who will grow up as a finer mensch, he thinks he gets nachas from popularity. And that desire for popularity, that desire to love and be loved more than anything else, overrides his decisions in raising his children and blinds his judgment. That was Chom and Canaan. Chom led by his passions, not by his mind. His mind followed his passions. His passions were dominated by a desire to love and be loved. His passions were desired by a sense of closeness. His passions were dominated by his sense of closeness with his son Canaan, to the point that he was unable and unwilling to see that there was anything wrong at all. This wicked man, Hayadua Berisha, says the Sikuna, that Canaan who everybody knows was so wicked, everybody except Chom knew that he was wicked. That was the Rishus of Chom, that he'd allowed a relationship to develop with his child, which blinded him to the wickedness of his own child, and therefore resulted in his inability to respond to that wickedness and to correct it. And for that he's blamed, and that's why his name is put in the parsha over and over again as Chom, the father of Canaan. He was the one, although Canaan, it's true, was the source of the evil, although it's true that Chom's evil was an imitation of Canaan's, nevertheless, had Chom been a proper father, Canaan would never have developed that way. If that's the way it is with our children, how much more so it is with ourselves. How difficult it is to see any wrong in ourselves, to respond to any wrong in ourselves, to take corrective action. How difficult it is. And perhaps that's a further reason why the Ribbono Shel'olam created us in these family units. If we can train ourselves to see our children as people who are intimate to us with regard to our responsibility, but distant from us with regards to our judgment of them and education of them, if we will be able to take somebody so close to us as our own children and just move them away a little bit so that we can take a proper look at them and see them in perspective, it might become a little bit easier for us to do it with ourselves. Maybe it was too much to expect us to be able to do it with ourselves without going through the exercise of being able to do it with a child. Once one has been a successful parent, once one has been able to see one's child in perspective, it is possible that one might be able to see oneself in perspective, to guide oneself and rule oneself with the same sense of accuracy, balance and perspective with which we rule others and with which we should rule our children. That is the requirement of Torah parenthood, and that is the requirement of a Torah life as far as one is concerned oneself. And Yitz Hashem, as we go through our lives, towards that we should aspire, the ability to see ourselves in that perspective and handle ourselves with the musa, with the self-perfection and self-improvement for which we all strive. Good luck.